Hiya, Wanju, hello, welcome to another episode of The Curb. I'm Andrew Pierce, and this is the podcast where I bring you in-depth interviews with filmmakers, creatives, and creators of culture. This podcast is recorded in Boorloo, Western Australia, sovereignty never ceded. With her debut feature film, Queens of Concrete, Eliza Cox takes audiences on a seven-year journey with three skateboarders, Ava Godfrey, Charlotte Heath, and Hayley Wilson. They each embrace a different style of skateboarding, with street and park being the two styles that are featured at the Tokyo and Paris Olympics. It's that 2020 Olympics in Tokyo that the girls have set their sights on, with Eliza following their journey from the skate parks of Melbourne to the sponsored events in London and LA to boarding schools dedicated to bringing up the next generation of skaters. There is an inherent drama to skateboarding. You never know if the skater is going to fall, what they're going to pull off, how they're going to take a risky jump. And that's paired with the inherent drama of being a teenager turning into an adult, or in the case of Charlotte, a kid turning into a teenager. Each of their girls has their own life journey to follow, and Eliza's dedicated observational lens follows them into a caring and a considered manner. This is not a director simply documenting the lives of their subjects, but supporting their journey in an empathetic manner that makes for a really captivating and powerful film. Queens of Concrete moves in the same vein as the great skating docos of the turn of the millennium, with Eliza noting the impact that Dogtown and Z-Boys had on her work. As a viewer, I couldn't help but feel the pull of Eddie Martin's excellent All This Mayhem, a film which also hails from the streets of Melbourne. Either way, the impact of sports documentaries is a strong one on Eliza's creative vision. I caught up with Eliza ahead of the AIDC panel Leveling the Playing Field, celebrating trailblazers in sports docos, where she joins fellow documentarians Frances Elliott, who co-directed Renee Gracie Fireproof, and Marley Silva of the upcoming film Skin in the Game. In the following interview, we talk about her journey into filmmaking, what it means to be a supportive director, the choice behind making a sports film about girls, or a film about girls who skate, and a lot more. If you're in NAR Melbourne this weekend, then make yourself known and head along to Acme on Monday the 3rd of March, where you can catch Leveling the Playing Field alongside a stack of other great panels and events at the Australian International Documentary Conference. If you want to purchase tickets or anything like that, visit aidc.com.au, as well as to check out the rest of the conference details. And if you want to find out more about what we do on The Curb, then head over to thecurb.com.au. We are a completely independent and ad-free website that lives on the support of listeners and readers just like yourself. If you can and you have the means to support us, then please visit patreon.com/thecurbau to support our work from as little as $1 a month. Right, here's the trailer for Queens of Concrete, followed by my interview with Eliza Cox.
Come on! 2020 is going to be the first time ever that skateboarding is an Olympic event.
Are you guys skater girls?
Yeah.
I hope to qualify. I'm so excited.
Hayley Wilson, the Australian champ.
Ava Godfrey,
top three in the country.
How about Charlotte Heath, a force to be reckoned with?
Do you want to win the Olympics?
I want to be the best in the world.
Looking back at those little girls from 8 years ago, is there anything you'd want to say to them?
You don't know what's to come.
I'm joined by 12-year-old Olympic hopeful.
A lot of the other sports will have age limits, whereas skating doesn't. You're throwing a very young person into a dog-eat-dog situation.
And there is pressure, and everyone wants a piece of you.
And she's got to go next level.
They have to perform.
She's only in primary school.
I spent $2,000 to get here.
It's our last chance to qualify.
Coach was pretty much shit. I wasn't speaking to my parents.
But felt like I had to keep going.
Is everything okay, Ace?
And this pressure just building.
She stopped hanging out with friends.
How nervous are you?
This is her entire teenage experience.
This is not just a contest.
I'm excited to make Australia proud.
This is the Olympic Games.
Oh my God!
It's not what skateboarding should be about. You know, to just go skate with friends and have a good time.
As soon as I stopped skating, I realised I'm an actual teenager.
I did it to make other people happy.
I really want my own life now.
Are you in love?
Well, not yet.
Cough out.
Yes.
You don't have to be the person that everybody wants you to be. Just trying to figure out who you are and where you stand.
I get a feeling of freedom.
How did you come into the orbit of these three wonderful people and get to know who they are as skateboarders.
Yeah, it started as a short film. I always have had an interest in skating and skateboarding, and when I was 17, it was around the time that Lords of Dogtown and the Z-Boys films had come out, and I grew up on the New South Wales Central Coast, so beautiful place to grow up, not too much happening and certainly no real visibility back in those like early 2000s of women in sport. So I loved surfing and skating but didn't stick with it because it was just a little bit too intimidating. But fast forward to 2016, and I'd heard whispers that there was talks that it would be in the 2020 Olympics. They were just about to make that announcement, and I was also dating a skater at the time, and I also saw a woman who looked around my age at the skate park locally, and she was just ripping. So it was kind of like a whole confluence of things came together that brought skateboarding back onto my radar, and I just began to get, a little bit curious about what it was like for girls in skating these days. And it did start as a bit of like a reflection on gender in male-dominated sports, but like, as we'll talk about later, it became a bit more than that. But the in terms of the three girls specifically, I knew that to make a film about girls in skating, to get the validation from an audience, they'd have to be like really good skaters. Like, and so I had a look at who the like the local leagues and ladders online, that who was doing well, and spoke to a couple of skate shops that, of course, like skate shops tend to sponsor teams and things like that. And so the same three names kept coming up: Haley, Ava, and Charlotte. And there was a couple of others in the mix. But doing the short film gave me the opportunity to see, first of all, what they were like in camera, like in front of camera, and did they have any charisma at all, and what kinds of characters they could be. And also, like, gave me a chance to see, like, what kind of film it might become and try out a few different things. So we were lucky in that the three of them made, like, a good duo, and because women's skating in Victoria was quite small then, they all knew each other. So for them, it was just a day off school and tons of lollies and takeaway. So they had a great time, and all I had to do was just be a bit of a dork. And, it was good. It was fun.
Mm. You frame them, like, when we meet them, first of all, they're obviously really young, but then you frame them with the same location, like the three of them sitting on that bench. Where is that location in proximity to things?
Yeah, so it was all in Melbourne, and I just, like, because it started as a uni short film that didn't have much budget, so we're looking for, like, local skaters, but also Victoria does have, like, quite a big female skate community, and I wanted to really take on that skating 90s aesthetic in the film, in terms of, like, quite desaturated, and skate parks are very grey and the colours are pretty washed out anyway. So that we did choose locations that would, like, enhance that a little bit. But it starts very local, the film, and then obviously as their lives go on, it becomes very international, and suddenly we're having to fully commit to this film and travel overseas with them and that kind of thing. And so I think that helps legitimize their story a little bit, but we start in Melbourne City and go from there.
I love the one of my favorite documentaries is All This Mayhem by Eddie. It's just a brilliant brilliant film, and that puts skateboarding to me, like, as I live in Perth, Western Australia, we've got a huge skateboarding scene here too, but All This Mayhem really put skateboarding in Australia on the map for me as a film watcher. And then getting to see this, it's like, oh, I know those locations, but they're now, like, the evolution of those locations as well. There's been so much interest in skateboarding, not just, for men, but for women as well. And it's fantastic to see this kind of boom of this sport.
Absolutely.
What does that mean for you to be able to capture that kind of transition on screen?
Yeah, very lucky. We were really lucky to get it at that time. And skating, like talking to veterans that have been around skating for like decades, it does tend to go in cycles every like 15 to 20 years at like peaks and then troughs and then peaks and then troughs. But I think that the Olympics absolutely just blew it up, but also in conjunction with COVID and lockdowns and that kind of thing, everyone getting outside. Most towns have a local skate park within their 5 kilometre radius or whatever. So everyone was getting out and about skating. I got out again and did it myself. And I think the Olympics in particular has been great for women's skating because it's meant that women have had a lot more opportunity. Countries have to provide equal amounts of women and men. And so suddenly you're seeing all these women around skateboarding and on TV, these like 12, 13, 14-year-olds, and it just is a lot more accessible. But I think the skaters that were around back in the days that are covered by all this mayhem in the 90s and that kind of things, they're, a lot of them are the ones now that are like spearheading and leading the younger ones through those Olympic pathways and that kind of thing. So without that heritage, like it'd be interesting to see where we are today. I've been in touch with Eddie Martin quite a bit, especially in the early days of the project, with joint interest in documentary and skateboarding, and all this mayhem just blew my mind. Such an incredible film. And yeah, he was being really helpful, and especially my approach and me being so green, it was great to have his advice. So yeah, I appreciate it.
Yeah, he's been a huge part of what I've done as a writer as well. He was the very first person I ever interviewed. And just,
wow.
Yeah, like, and you know, when I started, so I've been doing this for about 10 years, and it was on the strength of all this mayhem that I was like, you know what, I really like this film. I thought it was quite good. I might just send the guy an email and be like, hey, would you like to do an interview? And he's so generous, right? He's so generous with his time and his guidance. And that's a huge thing to have somebody who's being able to go, I'm going to be able to support you, give you the information that I know, because you never know, you might be that person for somebody in the future as well. And that is like it's a textual thing as well in Queens of Concrete too. Like you're talking about the people in All This Mayhem and the 90s films, they're now kind of teaching and guiding people. And I guess what I'm kind of getting at is this generational change. I remember way back when down in Fremantle, they wanted to put up a skate park down there, and all these old people, they petitioned and they protest, and they're like, oh, we don't want the youth here and all this kind of stuff. And now it's like this huge destination place, and it is that generational shift. But the generational shift doesn't come without having somebody guiding it, like older people saying, yeah, hey, let's nurture this. How important was it for you to have that, I guess, from somebody like Eddie, but then to also capture that on screen too, to see that kind of nurturing, not just from skateboarders, but from parents as well?
Yeah, it's interesting. Like when we first started filming the girls, like all of their parents were so quick to say it's such a misunderstood sport. Like there's such a community in skating. That was Ava's number one reason for skating, really. She loves the community, and so it's interesting the way that it's perceived. I do think the girls starting so young probably were maybe a little bit naive in some ways. It perhaps they just hadn't experienced that yet. Of course, there's the big competitions now, Street League and, you know, Olympic. There's a lot of money in competition, but there's still also that, which is, and the competition is the shiny, nice side that you see on TV that like really helps get people out of the house, which is really fantastic and important and empowering for everyone else. There is still street skating. It's still a massive part of skateboarding and video parts and that kind of things. And of course there's like 19, 20 year olds probably, you know, running amok out on the streets, and that's also part of it. You know, it's still an expression of identity. That's what skateboarding's always been. And so I do think, yeah, there has been a shift away from it, especially with the with the money and the business coming into those bigger comps. And it's great. It just provides more pathways and even more avenues for people who want to work in the skating industry but don't necessarily want to compete, or perhaps they want to be filmers or in marketing or something like that. So I feel really, you know, I feel like so grateful for this film, and so many things have just worked in our favour, and in particular the explosion of it over the last 8 years has been really, couldn't have planned it better, you know?
Well, I guess with that in mind, like, as you're saying, like, you've got the 2020 Olympics coming up, that kind of stuff in your mind, that's kind of a destination point. Obviously, pandemic comes along, kind of throw things out of whack. But when you're planning something, kicking off in 2016 and filming then, how do you kind of sequentially go, right, I think that we're going to hit these particular events and stuff like that? How do you plan that as a director?
There's, I guess you have to have an idea on what the story is going to be, like the skeletal structure of it. I always knew that it was not going to be necessarily a sports girl powery doc, but for the sake of a spine and chronology and structure of the film, we were going to have to follow the girls up until the 2020 Olympics and then allow 6 to 12 months after that for filming and reflection and that kind of thing. And just through a bit of research, skateboarding was going into the 2020 Olympics was like pretty disorganized. It was like struggling, as with any new sport would, to figure out the pathway and the qualification system. And so there was a few false starts, and especially with COVID thrown into the mix, bit of a scramble in terms of what Olympic qualifying event is and that kind of thing. But we knew that, say it was going to be a 2020 Olympics, there would be a year or two of qualifying events beforehand that we would likely have to go to. And just looking at the girls' ages, there would also be milestones, you know, like turning 18 or getting your license, like graduating school. So if we just sort of planned for those kinds of things and then allowed a bit of capacity there for like ad hoc shooting, I figured like surely that's enough to make a film. Yeah, but a lot of it came down to knowing what the story was going to be structurally, and that was a big help in guiding us.
Yeah. So when something like, you know, going off and getting a scholarship and then all of the stuff that happens with that, like that's a huge thing, which kind of throws your story in a different direction. How do you prepare yourself to be able to pivot outside of that planned idea of where you might be going?
Yeah, it's an interesting balance. It's a really interesting balance. And I think ultimately you have to be open to, first of all, you want to make an honest story, right? And something that's true and unique and authentic. And it is a bit of a dance in terms of when you are getting to the end of a project or to the end of shooting, you might have an idea about what you have and what you don't have and the things that you need to fill the gaps. And so you can be a little bit more picky towards the end of the shooting, but when life doesn't go to plan, that's just so much more interesting for the audience, and they want to know that. No one wants to see someone living their best life, like achieving and achieving and achieving, because it's not relatable. And I also would have felt like it was a disservice to the girls to not tell it honestly, but absolutely, like, you have to weigh that up with, can you afford to fly to like LA and Portland and cover that? And a lot of it sort of comes down to research. Do you know that if you're going to go on this big shoot or whatever, that you're going to be able to get what you want? And have you spoken to the participants and the coaches and the people that are facilitating the trip? Do they know what your expectations are? Because you don't want to commit to going on this trip or whatever or covering this aspect of their lives if you're not going to be able to get what you need. So some of it comes down to research. A lot of it is a gamble, and you kind of have to decide whether you're happy to take it or not, and whether those reasons are enough for you.
But with that in mind as well, like, you are not just a documentarian here, but you're also a confidant, right? You're somebody who's acting as a support for the girls and somebody that they can bounce off. And in that regard, like we're talking about, you know, the act of therapy, I guess, is the best way of putting it. And you are sometimes stepping into the role of being a therapist. So you're wearing different hats here. How do you balance that and kind of keep yourself safe in the process and keep them safe too?
Yeah, that for sure, that's the most difficult part. I found that the most difficult part of the whole project. It's because as much as I want to have no bias, I do have a bias because I'm the director of a film, and so I have a stake in the film and trying to get the best story possible. It comes down to relationship building, and do you have a strong enough relationship with the girls and their families to be able to have really honest conversations with them in terms of, do they feel like they can trust you to say, I don't want to talk about that, or I don't want to film that right now? Do they trust me enough to be able to tell me things and be okay with me covering that? Like, do they feel safe in that way? Perhaps there are like backups down the track. So when we were filming, we more or less said, we want to film everything, and when we get to the edit, you'll be able to have a look. And if you feel like there's something in the film that isn't true or honest or is compromising your safety or something like that, absolutely, let's talk about it. It's up for discussion. Like, your safety is the main priority. But if it's a shot that's like, you don't like your hair or you don't like the way that you look, that's not a grounds for vetoing something, sort of thing. So there's that. There's the trust and the relationship building in there, but I also found it really hard at times to balance the line. And there were times when I had to step back purely because I was, you know, burning out and too invested, really. And my producers would have to tap me on the shoulder and be like, mate, you got to look after yourself. Like, it's not your job. Even though I do feel responsible, like, it's not, they've got other support networks around them. Equally, there have also been other times, like when we were in London in 2018 with Hayley, it's her first big comp, and she's clearly struggling and feeling the pressure. But on that trip, that was the first big trip we ever took, and I didn't know Hayley super well then. I was like fresh out of film school, and so I had in the back of my mind, just stay, don't get involved, just fly on the wall. But I realise now, and have realised in the last couple of years, I should have been more of a support to her. And that doesn't mean that, like, that would not have necessarily affected the filming or the footage that I got. It's just about being there for her because she had no one else, really. And so I've apologised to her a couple of times then. So it's just a dance, and it's really only something you can get better at over time, and as you experience and as you learn, that knowing when to trust your instincts and when to not is, there's no hack for that. You just have to go through it and learn. But without a doubt, like, without having that relationship, you've got nothing. So everything, that's the foundation for all of that ethical stuff. It has to be there.
Yeah. And I mean, that's the thing, right? We're only human. And
exactly.
Like, this effectively, like, 8 years of life of the film from like 2016 to 2024 coming out and being released. So that's a long time to spend, not just with a film, but with the people who you're actually making the film about or with, right? And that's the relationship building. And on a very minute level, like, what I get to do, I get to talk to people like yourself, and usually I'm in your life for maybe 45 minutes, an hour, you know, if that, right? So, and yet there's a responsibility in me sharing your story, just as there's a responsibility in you sharing their story. But 8 years, again, like, it's that relationship building. Yeah, it's huge.
Yeah, it is. And I was really dreading the day that I was going to have to show a cut to the to the girls and their families. I was dreading it, and I had to really like back myself and be like, no, this is, you know, really talk myself around and believe in it. And I did, and also lean on my team and that kind of thing. And I, really the only feedback that the girls ever gave was, can you put more skating in, which is like classic because they're so resilient and like they, I don't know, I, you know, they've all skated in on the world stage, and I should have known that that would have been their main concern. But yeah, that responsibility is big. And just, I guess, back to what we were saying before, like I've also gone to measures to make sure that I'm okay and that throughout the process. So made, like I'm lucky to have grown up in a family of, you know, psychologists and counsellors and that kind of thing. So mental health is number one, and made sure that throughout this process I've been seeing my own counsellors and therapists and chatting with mentors and doing whatever it is I got to do to keep going. So, you know, exercising really like quite regularly and like eating well, or also perhaps, you know, having a wine when I need to. Like it's just a matter of listening to what I need and looking after myself so that I can be a better support to the girls and also my team.
Yeah. I find it so fascinating that obviously it makes sense that they would push for more skateboarding in the film. But in that regard too, like then I imagine in the edit, you have a decision of going, is this a skateboarding film about girls or is this a film about girls who happen to be skateboarders, right? And trying to find that balance there has got to be difficult. Did you find that difficult to kind of navigate, or did you have something that you were able to touchstone and go, no, my original vision was this?
Well, it was always going to be about the girls first. And to be honest, if someone had, like, given up on skating altogether, that would have been great for the film, like, for the story, you know? Like, it's – and they all did dip in and out of skating at times, but I just have really felt that skateboarding itself is such an incredible thing to watch on screen, regardless of whether you're a skater or not, and it has that really theatrical element to it. So we used it throughout the film as a bit of a vehicle to keep people engaged amongst all the ups and downs and to give people a bit of breathing space. And it's just it's also just cool. Like it would give the film a bit of like, I don't know, what's the word? Levitas, if to just have that skateboarding edge in it. Again, like they're great skaters, so if it had just been me, for example, pushing around on a skateboard, that's not cinema. Like that's not impressive. So it was always going to be about the girls first and their story, and we were using skateboarding as a vehicle to get there, is what I'm trying to say.
Well, there's an inherent drama to skateboarding, right? Because you don't know if they're going to fall, you don't know what tricks they're going to do, all this kind of stuff. So that's exactly a cinematic quality there. But it's fascinating. Yeah. Like, it really is. And it's interesting, like, coming back to AIDC, like, I'm thinking of Francis and Sam's first film, and off the top of my head, I can't remember the name of it, but I think it's Girl Like Me. But that was another film, just like yours, that they shot over, you know, 8 years or so, and it's this relationship that they have with the subjects. And part of the reason I bring it up is I'm chatted with Natasha Gad, obviously CEO of AIDC, about documentary filmmaking. And I love catching up with her because she has so many different viewpoints on documentary filmmaking. But specifically this year with AIDC, it's about future storytelling. And part of that is the function and form and breaking what a documentary can be. And a lot of that, like the rules, you read a lot of the rules, is you don't have a relationship with the subjects, you know, you stay distanced, you are an observer, not a participant, that kind of stuff. And yet, some of the best films I've seen, like yours, are just breaking that in a way. And the same with Francis and Sam's work, like it's just, they're breaking that in a way that is really enjoyable, and it's making the subjects almost a co-author, you know, they're not subjects, they're co-authors, they're participants in their own story. Do you say that at all is your form of documentarian directing?
I just think like audiences these days are quite smart. Like they know that whatever you show it, regardless of how objective you may be trying to be, it's always going to come across with a bias, with the filmmaker's bias. And I think, you know, having so much content readily available now, and with the, like, explosion of reality TV in the last couple of decades, like, people are beginning to clock on to that kind of thing. And so there's that aspect to it, which I think, like, some observational films are meant to be observational films purely because of what the story is. But I think when it comes to knowing what approach to take, it does come back to the story and what you're trying to convey and what the point is of what you're trying to film, and that will inform your approach. Like, I certainly didn't go out and mean to create such deep relationships, and I didn't want to be on screen and at all, and that kind of thing. It's just what I was making ended up having to be that way. And first of all, because I'm not going to get as good material if I don't have relationships with the participants, and also they're not actors, so I do sort of have to be present a little bit with these kids to try and get them to open up. And so and that's what I mean in the sense of, like, the story itself lent to being less traditional. So it's an interesting one. I'm intrigued as to where that might go. I did certainly over the next few years, and if documentary will continue to veer away from that, or if it will revert, as things tend to do, you know, go into a cyclical, sorry, I'm losing my thought now, become a cycle. So yeah, I certainly tried to, for the sake of my own energy in the early days, hack the relationship thing a little bit and kind of be like, I wonder if I just almost give bare minimum if I can get away with still making a film. And it just, you just can't. You have to go and be present for things and show face at comps, even though you know you're probably not going to use the material. There's no substitute for that. For my film is what I'm saying.
Well, I mean, it's about trust building, right? And I think of, like, for Australian documentaries in 2024 in particular, I think your film, I think of this documentary Like My Brother, and then also Rene Gracie Fireproof. They're all showing this kind of advocacy for women in sports and the struggles that come with that, especially in Australia, which is such a male-dominated space in so many different ways, whether it's, you know, motorsport racing, skateboarding or football. It's all these different things. Mm. So to have the space to be able to tell those stories on screen with the participants involved, you have to have the trust building, right? It's foundational.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely. So it's journalism 101 as well. And that's how I came into documentary, through that pathway. And so much storytelling happens before you've even turned the camera on, you know. It's about, building that relationship and spending time with people before you even try and capture it on screen.
But it's also a sense of not leaning into, like, gotcha storytelling as well, like, which is, again, it's journalism 101, but there also seems to be a real push in some areas to really lean into that style of journalistic storytelling or documentary storytelling of, again, that really detached, I'm the documentarian, you're the subject, whatever you do is fair game kind of thing. I don't like that kind of stuff myself. And it's clear you don't either, because you've collaborated quite clearly well with them. And it's a powerful film, which then leads me to the responses to the film. Like, I imagine that having, because it screened at MIFF and, you know, the reaction, that kind of stuff, getting to see an audience there, what kind of reaction did you get from that?
Yeah, really blown away. The premiere night was huge. And I think, first of all, Melbourne made film, Melbourne cast and crew to premiere in Melbourne with 8 years worth of people following along, packed into that cinema, was huge. And every time someone new appeared on screen, the audience was cheering. And it was, really mind-blowing. And, you know, we sold out we sold out screenings, the remaining screenings, got an encore screening, and then it's gone on to be at Cinefest and nominated Best Feature at South by Southwest Sydney. And so that's, it's hard to, like, I was at dinner last night with the editor and my producer, and I was like, they're like, it's been so well received. And I was like, has it? Like, I just can't really tell from where I'm sitting because I'm so in it, you know? And they're like, are you kidding? And it's, yeah, it's just sort of funny and bizarre to me, but really affirming and gratifying. It was the main thing, my main priority on the night of the premiere was that the girls had a great time and that they felt safe and held and looked after. And, you know, we had a counsellor there, like, kind of standing by and in the days leading up to, and still available for them now if there are things they want to chat about with that counsellor. And I just wanted them to feel supported, and they were all very nervous about the Q&A afterwards, like, really nervous. I knew them well enough by then to know that they would actually sort of smash it, and they did. Hayley did a natural mic drop after the Q&A. Like, they just had the best time, and yeah, it was great full circle moment.
Well, I mean, that's the thing, right? Like, I know I've done enough interviews that I hopefully provide a comfortable space for people. But when you're going on a stage in front of a bunch of people, you have no idea and you don't really know what the questions are going to be like. It's a nerve-wracking experience. So it's good to hear that, you know, certainly having a mic drop moment is got to be entertaining.
Yeah, they were just loving it, loving the limelight. Couldn't pull them away from the media wall, just getting photos nonstop. Like, it was nice. Great.
When, I mean, obviously you're still in the midst of this mindset of Queens of Concrete, but as a storyteller, as a documentarian, what kind of stories do you want to continue telling on screen?
Yeah, I think for me it will always be quite human-centred and people-centred, and something that will always be relationship based. And even hearing myself say that, I am a little bit scared just after the last 8 years, but I think that's just kind of the person that I am, and I can't get away from it. Intrigued by people and why we do the things that we do. I'm such a believer in, you know, a lot of life isn't black and white, it's all grey, and there's nuance and reason for things, the reasons for the way that people act. And I love the idea of getting out into different environments, spending some time with people, and eventually getting a camera out and following them around. I'm beginning, this was my first feature film. I've made a couple of shorter films. And I suspect that perhaps my style is that they need to be watched a couple of times, just from what I've heard people keep telling me that, yeah, it was great the first time, but then I watched it the second time and really caught a lot more. And I don't know really what that says about me or the way that I make films, but I suspect it will be more of that just because I like to leave a lot left unsaid, but to prompt some thinking and reflection from the audience. So I grew up, like I said, my interest is always come from journalism. I grew up watching a lot of Enough Rope when Andrew Denton would be interviewing taxi drivers and butchers and really normal everyday people, and that's the kind of stuff I want to make that I'm fascinated by. So I think what I'll try next is probably going to be something episodic, just because I'm intrigued by that side of it. But I'll probably never quite get away from documentary, I don't think.
Well, there's, I mean, it's one of the things, as I said, like, it's what I return to as somebody who writes and talks about film a lot. I love, you know, fiction and stuff like that, and, you know, scripted stuff is great, but there's something just that's so refreshing about documentary storytelling. And, you know, I get to talk with people like yourself and get to hear that different side of things, which is great, but it's also just getting to see the world differently. As you mentioned, like Andrew Denton, right? Getting to see and hear the world from somebody who you don't hear from, a butcher, a taxi driver, it's massive, right? Because suddenly they're put on the spotlight in a way that, you know, they probably aren't used to. And we certainly, as audience members, aren't really getting to see the world from their perspective most of the time. And our interaction with them is so minimal too. And transactional, exactly. I guess, is the best way of putting it. And I guess for you as a storyteller, then getting to reshape how people see the world, that's got to be, that's a gift, right?
I would love, I mean, if that's what I am doing and can do, then that's really all I want to do. And I think, I just think we can live in such small worlds and such small bubbles when there's so much more to see and so much more to understand. And I kind of want to see it all and hear it all and learn it all and do it all. And I wish I didn't. I wish I just wanted to sit at home and, like, crochet and, I don't know, read a book. But I'm just curious. And I don't know. Some of that's probably my upbringing, the era I was brought up in. And, you know, just really luckily empowered by my parents to just do what it learned, go out and do whatever you want to do. And so I think the world, I guess, a reason why I am interested in that kind of thing is that it promotes empathy and with other people, and which is lacking a lot in these days in society. And if I can do something to help soften that, then fantastic. That's all I really want to do.
Your parents sound like wonderful people and very encouraging. What kind of things was it like if you said, I want to go and do this, they were okay? Or did they encourage you to go, hey, have you thought about this kind of thing?
They were generally, that's a good question. They've always been supportive of more or less whatever I've wanted to do. Like I tend to, if I'm even now at almost 36, if there's a big decision I'm looking at making, I'll run it past them just to gauge their thoughts, or even just for my own sake to voice all my thinking and logic behind it. And usually they'll back me 100%. They always will. I think a lot of that comes from, you know, their generation having to being pushed into things they didn't want to do. So they would say to all my siblings and I, just make sure whatever you're doing, you love it and you're passionate about it, which I actually now sort of hate that advice. I kind of wish, like, I said to them the other day, I wish you'd pushed me into, like, I don't know, teaching or nursing or something. Like, nothing, like, working in the arts for the love of it is a bit of an oxymoron. I think it's hard to do. And which is why, you know, it's become more of a balancing act. But I've been very lucky, yeah, with my parents and my family and the way that I grew up, the situation that I grew up, it's purely luck that I was born and raised the way that I was. And it's an immense, like, privilege, and to have the luxury of making a film. Not everyone has that, and I totally recognize that. And
I mean, I wish I would be across for AIDC. I've covered this conference for years and years and years, but I've never actually flown across. So I need to do that one time. But like, this is the panel that you're part of, like, is exactly the kind of thing that I would love to go and listen to and hear talk, because leveling the playing field, celebrating trailblazers in sports docs, like, it sounds like really exciting, because we do a lot of sports documentaries in Australia. And I guess when you're talking about that confluence of being an artist for the art's sake and that kind of stuff, Australia is a sports nation first, in my opinion, right? So getting to see that explored on screen in the way that you've done here is fascinating and exciting. And I'm curious if you can talk about that sense of exploring sports on screen and what you hope from the panel might be the discussion points coming out of it.
Yeah, few things. First of all, I love sports docs so much. I have always loved sport myself, and have so many unfulfilled sporting dreams that I think is probably the reason why I love it. I also love an underdog story, and so those two things together, I've probably watched more sports docs than anything else, to be honest. But I think as a woman, I find that hard to admit. There's something about it that feels quite masculine, and still, which is a shame, and that shouldn't, gender shouldn't even come into it, but it does. And I guess that's how me making the film started, like an exploration of, I'm also a female filmmaker in a male-dominated industry, so there's that parallel there too. And I think there's a lot of space in Australia for female filmmakers in that area. It's such a niche area. You, like, yes, Australia is a big sporting nation, but the documentary community itself is quite small, and then you narrow down even further to female sports making sports docs, and that's tiny. And so I hope that as space opens up in sport for more women, in more female involvement, that is echoed in documentary filmmaking, because regardless of like what gender you are, there's that almost everyone can lend something to a documentary. Like everyone has something to contribute in their art and in their filmmaking, and it shouldn't even be about really ticking off the boxes of what a sports documentary is or what a documentary is. It's just about, what do you want to make, and just do it, you know? And do you believe in what you're doing? Because great, that's all you really need. So I hope that people come away from that panel and from that session feeling empowered. I mean, the great thing I think about sports docs is that you can get away with pretty low budget equipment, and you can do it on a shoestring pretty easily just because of the action and that kind of thing. You don't need to have a $10,000 camera or whatever. It's pretty accessible. But ARDC, that's why I love ARDC. Like I was saying before, yeah, documentary filmmaking in particular can feel pretty lonely at times, and being amongst that community is always such a good reminder that you're not alone. There's tons of people out there that are trying to do the same thing, so let's connect and put, you know, everything else aside and really feed that passion and interest in storytelling, I guess. So that's what I would hope people come away with.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great lineup. The people there are phenomenal, and again, like, just getting to be part of that and listening to all the things is superb. So I'm excited for you, and I'm excited for anybody who's heading along to go and see it and listen to it. It'll be great. I guess as we lead into wrapping up, one of the questions which I always ask people, and it's a not an easy one to answer, but we've kind of already talked about it in some regards, which is what it means to be an Australian filmmaker and being able to tell Australian stories on screen. We've kind of talked about it in the sports sense and putting these great girls' stories on screen. But for you personally, what does it mean to be able to tell an Australian story like this on screen?
I guess, Australian culture is just very unique. It's, you know, our sense of humour, the kinds of stories that we tell, the fact that we're such a big country, it's almost a little bit like the Wild West, I think. And our way of life, you know, is very unique as well. We've got our own societal problems. We're so far away from the rest of the world. There's stories there that are new and different and haven't been told yet. And I think there's a lot to be learnt and a lot we can show the rest of the world. And I have been watching like the Australian content quotas on the streamers and that kind of thing, because I want to know that they're commissioning Australian stuff amongst the rest of the world, you know, and it's important. It's important. It would be great if there was some more support for Australian filmmaking. I think the government could certainly put a bit more funding in, as always, make it a little more accessible. But I think Australians have a sensitivity to things and just a naturally pretty amicable way with other people. So I don't know what it is. It's a way of relating to people that other cultures don't have, and I think that's pretty powerful. It can be pretty powerful to utilise. So there's certainly a space there and lots of opportunity if we can find it and have the means to take it.
And again, it's almost like that underdog status, like you're talking about the underdog story, right? That seems to be the way that Australian film is shifting back towards becoming an underdog, which is both a blessing and a curse. But with that said, I guess in reflection on Queens of Concrete, you've got these three people who are underdogs in some regard because, you know, skateboarding, whoever thinks of Australia as a skateboarding nation, well, we are, clearly, and we're really good at it. But there's also what I kind of love to see is that all three of them had their own style of skateboarding, which is seems to be an Australian style of skateboarding, right? And they're really pushing it, if there can be such a thing.
Yeah.
And I guess as we're leading to closing up, if you want to kind of talk about that underdog status and being able to apply an Australian sensibility to a national or an international sport like skateboarding and getting to showcase that on screen, how important is that for you as well?
Very important. I think, I don't know, Australian culture does have that whole underdog thing going on, for better or for worse, like in a lot of aspects of society. And I think underdog stories give hope, right? And that's what we all need right now. And you need to have a reason to get out of bed every morning and do what you're doing, and underdog stories do that. And I guess that's why it's important. It's why it's important to me. And yeah, I think that's all that it is for me. It's just about hope, giving people that hope, and empowering people to do whatever it is that they're wanting to do.
That's wicked. I appreciate your time. I appreciate the therapy session, I guess, in a way of putting it. It's not too deep, so it's okay.
No, thank you for having me.
It's been a delight.
Yeah, it's been good. Thank you. Thanks for your time, for your questions. Very thoughtful questions. It's been really nice. Really nice. So thank you.
Thanks again for listening to this interview with Eliza Cox, who will be attending AIDC on 3rd March 2025 for the panel Leveling the Playing Field. For more details, visit aidc.com.au and make sure to check out her film, Queens of Concrete. And for everything else related to The Curb, please visit thecurb.com.au. I'll see you on the next one.